I don't want no oil spoiling my shoreline. I like fish much better than crud. I like birds and things a-creeping and crawling. Won't trade no more oil for blood. The sun done give us all we need to make this country run. But that black demon oil's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time we was done. I don't want them nukes run by them kooks who think radioactivity is fun. No more three-headed frogs or kids with leukemia. Nuclear power ain't fit for a dog. The sun don't give us all we need to make this country run. But that nuclear power's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time we was done. No nukes!
Good morning, Toledo, and very good afternoon, Columbus, and a big hello to everyone in Bowling Green. Also, a big hello to those listening on the internet, wherever or whenever you may be. I'm your friend and host, Shehbaz Khan, and I am here with my stalwart co-host,
Rebecca Wood.
Welcome, Rebecca.
And welcome to you.
Together, Rebecca and I are going to bring you another brilliant hour of radio called For a Green Future. This show, For a Green Future, is a show where we talk about ecology and the environment. And we talk about them in the way that they affect you, your wealth, your health, your happiness, and the wealth and health and happiness of your friends and family. The wealth and health of the bear and the deer, and the herons and the snakes, because, like it or not, we are all along for the ride together on this rapidly heating wet rock floating in the space called Earth. So, we are back after a well-deserved vacation. We hope you enjoyed last week's encore presentation of our show. We certainly enjoyed the time off and used it to refresh our batteries, and we're ready, and we are ready to bring even more enthusiasm than usual. To our show this week, we are just going to chat for the next 15 minutes or so, and then we have a review of the new movie everyone's talking about. No, not Barbie, the other movie, Oppenheimer. Then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from our wonderful patrons and sponsors. And we have a new patron to announce, Rebecca. What are we going to talk about today?
Japanese beetles.
Japanese
beetles. They have lots
of parts. Wow. And that's very timely.
Yes.
That is so very timely.
It's time for them to start doing bad things to people's gardens, so.
Yeah, and they are starting to come out this time of the year. They usually come out this time of the year, right?
Yep.
Then we move on to ecological news. Unfortunately, environmental news is becoming more catastrophic and apocalyptic. Each week, it keeps on building. But we also managed to tease out some hopeful news as well. We are also asking you to call in at 877-909-1007. That is 877-909-1007. Dear listeners, I have one question we'd like to ask you. How was your vacation? A lot of people from this area head out to camping or hiking or fishing this time of the year. Have you gotten out into the nature yet this summer? How was your experience? Did you see anything interesting? You can feel free to call in with any of your comments you might have that or any other environmental topic you'd like to discuss. You can also text us with your comments on 419-973-5841. 419-973-5841. You can also email at joe at jodymayerforagreenfuture.org. The email is jodymayerforagreenfuture.org. One of the members of our staff likes to spend his vacation each year on a remote island in Lake Michigan, within the site of Upper Peninsula. Primitive camping, you know. He reports that this year the mosquitoes are out by millions. Also, there is definite transition going on. The island used to be covered mostly with cedar or birch trees. The birches are dying of a fungal infection, and the cedars are being displaced by deciduous trees like maples and nut trees. So the island is in a state of chaos, with dead trees mixed in with large older trees, dying trees, and many other trees that have been partially or completely knocked down over by storms. But on the other hand, a forest in this state provides a lot of habitat for bugs and insects. Lots of insects in turn means lots of birds. The island was awash in a constant stream of birds, bird songs from different species, many variant bird songs. One of the most dramatic species that has returned to the island is the bald eagle. There were bald eagle sightings almost every day. Unfortunately, the haze from the Canadian wildfires was also very heavy that far north. There are still over 580 wildfires blazing, with about half out of control. So far this year, about 11 million hectares have burned, an area almost the size of the state of Ohio. And I clearly remember Rebecca reporting on this show that when the wildfires began in Canada, they were the size of like Virginia. Now they are the size of state of Ohio.
Suggesting that they're not actually winning.
The wildfire is winning. It's growing. It's increasing. Now this state of Ohio is actually, it is 7 times more than the average. Our staffer reports that when he drove across Canada from Michigan to Buffalo, the smoke from the fires was so thick in some places that he had to drive with his headlights turned on in the middle of the day.
Yow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got an uncle who's going up to the Laurentides in Quebec to, I don't know, what he does, hike, camp, canoe, something. Maybe sort of an adventure. I hope it doesn't get too smoky for him.
Yeah, and I also believe that it might be very risky as well. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know.
I mean, driving through such wildfires and smoke and haze, clearly the visibility drops. So it in turn can be very hazardous, very risky.
He knows the risks. Apparently, he's a grown up. But I don't quite get it. But where are you going to go that's not on fire to be with nature these days? You know, come on.
So when I read this report from this staffer, I was really concerned about him, how he managed to drive across all those areas. I mean, I wouldn't have dared, actually. Okay, moving ahead. Of course, the above average wildfires are just one symptom of the larger global warming catastrophe we are experiencing. There are lots and lots of other symptoms. And this is the year that the mainstream media has finally noticed. We have been saying this since the start of the show back in 2019. That what are we were caught in, Rebecca? Do you remember what are we caught in?
Oh, is this a more positive feedback loop?
Yes, you are. Yes. You are right. Okay. You're so correct. Yeah. Positive feedback loop. Yes, that is right.
It sounds all nice and peppy, but it's really not good.
No, yes. No. The effect of global warming is more global warming. Yes. And in a positive feedback loop, the changes accelerate at the maximum rate possible until the whole system collapses. That is positive feedback loop. And it's very, very scary. Well, the system is finally collapsing. The BBC had a pretty good summary on its science page yesterday, July 22nd, entitled Climate Records stumble, leaving Earth in uncharted territory, scientists. Let's see, we had the hottest June on record, the hottest day ever recorded, 17.08 degrees centigrade, back on July 6th. Do you remember that, Rebecca?
I certainly do. It was quite warm.
Yeah. The hottest sea surface temperatures ever recorded. It's hard to describe just how dramatic this one is. The graph measuring surface temperature has become almost vertical. Antarctic sea ice.
I told my doctor that I was having trouble breathing on hot days, and she was just kind of like, oh, well, planet's on fire. What you gonna do?
Oh, my.
Like you and millions of other people. She didn't actually say, don't worry, we'll all be dead soon, but it was sort of implied.
So, as we were looking into the different aspects or symptoms, Antarctic sea ice, which is supposed to be increasing quickly since it's winter in Antarctica, it is actually covering millions of square kilometers less than it's supposed to. In fact, it is the lowest ever recorded for this day, for this date, by an incredible amount of fish, penguins, and all manner of sea creatures are washing up dead all over the world, or different parts of the world, killed either by high temperatures or lack of oxygen in the water caused by high temperatures. The waters around Florida are right around 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Just imagine that. I mean, you don't need a water heater.
Wow.
To warm up the water. Now, the sad part is people are dying by dozens all along the southern states, by the hundreds in India, and all over the northern hemisphere. The heat is also accompanied by massive rainstorms that are causing flooding in every continent in the northern hemisphere. So this is so strange. You have flooding, you have rainstorms, you have flash floodings, like that, severe incidences happening in India, but you are also having wildfires. I mean, what is happening to
it's,
the climate?
It's heat domes, apparently. Climate teleconnections. I read about this. Mm-hmm. When you have a heat dome, like there are heat domes in Africa right mm-hmm. now, and so and I think in south of that or downstream, downwind, I guess, from the jet stream, you tend to get of the heat dome, you tend to get rains and flooding.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the two are related. That's why you have, like, you know, you have up on one continent, you have the excessive heat, and then down low ways, you got the flooding.
Yeah. I wonder, I mean, I believe people understand we are interconnected, whether we live, you know, anybody living in India or Africa or wherever. Everybody is interconnected. I just hope our leaders, political leaders, realize that soon.
Yeah, that'd be lovely, yes.
Yeah. So that is the very sad part. So moving forward to this show, this is what we have been predicting about, is actually happening all along the way now. Most of us know and understand the dangers of global warming. But too few of us are doing anything about it. Not enough of us are putting solar panels on our houses or switching to electric cars or mass transit or insulating our homes. Most Americans aren't even switching to geothermal heating or trading their gas stoves for electric. Here in Ohio, we keep electing Republican lawmakers who are outright global warming deniers. They want us to move back to coal and oil and natural gas, even as those fuel sources are killing us. We told you so. See, we said that. Saying this is so thoroughly unsatisfying in this situation. Start bailing is more appropriate, I think. Everyone needs to start making the transition to a carbon-free green future. Today, right now, we need to begin right now. Don't buy a car you can't plug it. As we have said over and over on this show, the green future will be better. Less pollution, more comfort, higher standards of living than we have today, and much better than what will happen if we don't stop putting carbon in the air. But even now, it is possible for us to make this transition. There's an example. There are examples all over the world of countries that are making the transition to carbon-free energy. South Australia is one grid that we like to talk about. They are already more than 70% just wind and solar power. They regularly have stretches where wind and sun provide 100% or more of their power, allowing them to export clean electricity to their neighbors. In fact, the overwhelming consensus among scientists who have studied our energy systems agree that 100% renewable energy, that means no gas, no nukes, is possible. Friend of the show, Dr. Mark Jacobson of Stanford, put out a tweet on, I think it was July 18th, that listed 89 papers published in a peer-reviewed scientific journals written by over 200 scientists that all agree that we can have 100% renewable energy. That means no carbon, no nukes, no carbon sequestration, and no blue hydrogen. So when you see the dramatic stories of forest fires, heat waves, and flash floods, the worst possible attitude is it's too late to do anything, or I'd better buy a bigger SUV that won't get washed away in flood.
Okay, but bigger floods.
Yeah.
It's an arms race, honey bunch. Yeah.
Maybe we'll start living on boats then. Right, that reminds me of that movie, Kevin Costner, Waterworld.
I like that movie. I don't care what anybody says.
Okay. So, one of the attitudes is like, you know, I'd better buy a bigger SUV that won't get washed away in a flood. What you need to think about is, what's the next thing I can do to lower my carbon emissions? This should be the focus. Increasingly, Gen Z members are taking the biggest step an American can take towards a carbon-free future. Kudos and hats off to Gen Z members. They are not buying cars. In 2020, less than half the 16 and 17 year old Zoomers were eligible to get driver's license. Actually, 20% of 20 to 25 year olds also never got their licenses. Even fewer Gen Z people actually own cars. They prefer to use rideshare apps like Uber, Lyft, or other, or simply hop on to their electric scooters. Furthermore, while they do list cost of one reason they don't get cars, many of them actually say they don't want cars because they are concerned about the environment, whether it's economics or concern about the environment or opportunity to use alternative transportation method. It turns out the number of miles Americans drive each year peaked back in 2004. Up until 2004, the number of miles driven annually by Americans had increased each year. But in 2004, it hit 10,125. It has declined slowly, by fairly steadily since then. In 2021, it had dropped to 9,716. So, the trend is in the right direction. The question is, are we dropping the cars fast enough? The answer is still no.
Guessing not. Yep. Because no. It's still getting hotter fast.
Yep. I think all the car sales or automobile companies are reporting profits, increasing their sales, right?
Pretty much.
So that means somebody is buying the car.
Yeah, gotta be.
Well, now, unfortunately, baby boomers are keeping their licenses longer than they should. people over 85 are continuing to drive in record numbers. But that problem is expected to solve itself in the next 15 years. And so, a future without gas-guzzling cars is getting easier and easier to imagine as we see it actually happening around us.
Okay, but here's the thing. Okay, Uber, you still basically have one person per car, mostly. Maybe two.
So
it's
maybe
not a net savings of gas. I mean, if you have these people, I mean, you need actual buses and trains and stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's still one car, one person. It's just it's somebody else's car.
Somebody else's car, but, you know, that individual is not having a car, so he personally will be driving less.
Right, so, true. There's probably less sort of spontaneous, because you always think, oh yeah, this is going to cost me money if I want it.
Yeah. So spending the money might, you know, discourage and encourage the person to take a, you know, ride a bike, take a walk, just jog. If it's too far away, then Uber is a good option. Or maybe this will encourage the government to, you know, set up good transition, mass transition, transportation
options. You'd
really options.
Hope so. Yeah, that'd be nice.
Like many countries, they are putting up good transportation methods. Very, very nice, you know, trains and buses and all that, running on solar and electricity and other
Or even
power.
Cities which are not Toledo.
I wish and I hope we will get there soon.
Maybe, I don't know, we heard all this stuff about, oh yes, the transportation is going to improve in Toledo because we have this big levy, and as far as I can tell, they meant not get worse by improve.
Yeah. And see, this is where I believe, and this is what the show believes, that we need to come and become one, because the government won't do anything unless we become one, we get as united as one, and we raise this concern to the government.
Yep.
We need to get united. All right. So, a future without gas-guzzling cars is getting easier and easier to imagine as we see it actually happening around us. When you see someone whizzing by on an electric scooter, they are using less than 1/10 the amount of energy they would need if they were driving a car. As Dr. Jacobson has pointed out, electrifying everything, including transportation, means we need less energy overall, because electric motors are so much more efficient than internal combustion engines. It is not at all difficult to imagine using electricity and heat pumps to heat and cool our homes, using electric furnaces in industrial processes, switching over to electric agricultural equipment, even riding in electric boats. Then we'd be living in a world without tailpipes, a world that doesn't need refineries or pipelines, where we can stop going to foreign dictators, because we no longer need their country's oil. Such a world is not hard to imagine. And this is a world where fewer people die from heat strokes or pollution or exposure to radiation or chemicals. It's time for you to decide, you the people. Do you want to live in a world without pollution? A world where you are healthier, have more money to spend on things that you want, and having to spend less on gas or maintaining a car? Unfortunately, the one choice you don't have is just to keep doing things that the way we have been doing them for 100 years, using the chemical energy in fossil fuels to power everything. That choice has been taken away by the reality of atmospheric chemistry. Right now, this summer, we are reading about disasters such as flooding in South Korea and Italy, heat deaths in Mexico, India, but continuing to pump carbon dioxide into the air means those disasters will inevitably come here too. Supply chains would be broken, infrastructure destroyed, eventually the oil will stop flowing one way or the other. The consequences, if we try to continue with businesses as usual, are quite literally catastrophic.
I unsubscribed from a YouTube channel because it was about the Duggar fans, one of the Duggar gossip channels and reality gossip channel, and they were talking about how Josh Duggar is in prison in Texas because he did something very, very bad. Mm-hmm. And it's over 100 degrees and they have no air conditioning. And this lady was just like, oh, well, it's air conditioning. It's a frill. It's a luxury. There are no windows you can open in a prison. This lady lives in Minnesota or some crap. You know, she does not. No, it's not a luxury. Like, you can die without air conditioning. People probably are dying in that prison.
Yeah.
And you want to make you want to make capital punishment for certain crimes. Okay, fine, but don't cook people to death. That's not okay.
I was about to say that that person must be feeling like if he's in an oven?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I just, that's, human dignity is not a frill.
Mm-hmm. So, the consequences, if we try to continue with the business as usual, are quite literally catastrophic. It's a catastrophe that has already begun. And our only chance is to stop it from escalating. Since the 1940s, we have also lived in the shadow of another kind of catastrophe, the catastrophe of nuclear war. The movie Oppenheimer explores the roots of that threat to life on Earth. So we thought it would be a good to offer you folks a review of the movie. There are spoilers here, so get ready. First of all, the movie is visually stunning. That is, sometimes it feels as if you've been stunned by being hit between the eyes with an axe handle. The mysteries of quantum physics are represented visually by abstract images that kind of suggest electrons spinning around in their orbital shells, but also kind of just look like curvy lines. Just as the mind of a physicist can drop off into the quantum world anytime, the audience can find itself pummeled with this imagery at any time. This being a film, of course, imagery is of primary importance. More important than the narrative, which is definitely non-linear, jumping back and forth between past and present, black and white, and focus. It's so jumpy that it sometimes leaves you wondering what exactly the movie is about. That is such a trait, you know, Christopher Nolan's trait. He keeps you guessing, moving the story back and forth. I mean, he is a masterful storyteller. It's so jumpy that it sometimes leaves you wondering what exactly the movie is about. It's several stories at once. And just as the Heisenberg uncertainty principle tells us you can't know an atom's exact position and velocity, we can't know exactly who or what the movie is about. One of the storylines that roughly hold the movie together is the Senate confirmation hearings of Robert Downey Jr.'s character, Louis Strauss. He's trying to make the leap from being head of the AEC or Atomic Energy Commission to being Secretary of Commerce. However, in the process, gradually, the truth about this quantum entanglement with Oppenheimer gets teased out. The audience is allowed to think at times that the movie is actually about him and his bureaucratic ambitions, struggles, and maneuvers, but it's not. It's also not about the technical process and discovery that the scientists at Los Alamos went through to create the bomb. Although there is just enough of that touched on to get by. It is about the bomb, though, and again visually we keep returning to the assembly of the weapon. Even as the characters jump around in space and time like subatomic particles in quantum foam, the bomb is consistently shown as being assembled piece by piece. One striking image is the uranium core being packed into pentagon-shaped explosive that caused the implosion that sets off the nuclear chain reaction. if you know what that is already, you can't help but feel the satanic aspect of that imagery. But if you don't know what that image is, it probably just leaves you feeling a little bit bewildered. Another weird thing in a movie full of weird images. The weirdness is actually one of the main points of the movie. At one point, a young Oppenheimer studying in Europe stares at a Picasso painting for a very long time. It helps to make the point that the development of quantum physics that paved the way for the bomb was just one of many revolutions that were shaking all aspects of human reality, political, artistic, psychological, physical, etc. Staying away from the technical facts of bomb making, the movie uses those weird images to focus on the emotional impact of creating a weapon that can destroy everything. When Oppenheimer is in the intensely emotional situations, hallucinations can overwhelm his reality. It is a deeply paranoid movie as well. Being Jewish in World War II, paranoia is inevitable. Paranoia was inevitable. The Nazis...
We'll say trust issues, because someone was actually out to get them.
Yeah. So they were scared to death, actually. They might be being spied by the Nazis themselves, you know.
Right.
The Nazis were really out to get the Jewish people, and the necessity of defeating the Nazis was the triggering charge that started the chain reaction that led to the bomb. But the movie also makes the point that bombs were not completed until after Nazis had been defeated. Many of the characters are involved in extremely deep and subtle schemes that don't really get revealed to the audience until very late into the 3-hour movie. No one's motives are pure. There are no heroes. There is a surprising amount of talk about politics. The words communist, socialist, and fascist are thrown about more than you might hear in political documentary. But what those words actually mean is not discussed. It is assumed that the audience knows. It is actually assumed that the audience knows quite a bit. There is a line in the where Matt Damon's character, General Leslie Groves, is describing Oppenheimer to himself. Brilliance is a given. The writer and director, Christopher Nolan, assumes the audience knows quite a bit. But someone who has studied the history of atomic bomb creation might wonder at some of the things left out. For example, in the 1989 movie on the same topic, Fat Man and the Little Boy, we got to see how the young physicist Louis Slotin was sacrificed to die a horrible death from radiation exposure in the essential experiments that determined the point of criticality in a nuclear bomb. So they basically sacrificed the young physicist in the name of science.
Whoa, okay, well, I hope he was in on that.
and that is a very important point, I think, which the movie makers missed up. Something else that is missing in the environmental effects is the environmental effects of nuclear technology. There is a passing reference to the effects of the radiation being created might have on the female reproductive system, but no real discussion of how radiation actually kills things, just as Louis Slotin's death is left out. There is also a troubling use of language with the word isotopes. As we have reported here on the For a Green Future, one of the purposes of Ohio's HB434 was the creation of isotopes for research. But in reality, every atom in the universe is an isotope. There are stable, normal isotopes, and there are unstable radioactive isotopes. To distinguish them, radioactive isotopes are called radioisotopes or just radioactive isotopes. Calling them just isotopes is not only factually wrong, it eliminates the scary word radiation, which makes them seem benign and not deadly. So they are basically rebranding the
harmful. Very subtle, yeah. Like propaganda, yeah. Wow.
The process of refining uranium and creating plutonium are also mentioned, but not the deadly radioactive wastes that those processes created. Instead, the movie focuses on the big boom, the big explosion, and much like the nuclear industry itself doesn't trouble itself too much about the waste that explosion causes. So they don't really talk about what the explosion is causing, what nuclear waste and what harmful pollutants they are throwing out into the atmosphere. They also left out the discussion by the Nagasaki bomb. They also left out the discussion of why the Nagasaki bomb was dropped after the Hiroshima bomb had already demonstrated the power of the atomic bomb.
Okay, I thought that was because the Japan hadn't surrendered yet.
That's what they think, but they clearly demonstrated the power of the bomb.
Right.
So, I mean, they did not have to use it again. That's what I think.
Right. Mm-hmm. Just give them a minute. Yeah.
So, part of the reason was simple, cold logic, that while one bomb was uranium-based, the other was plutonium-based. So, this was the reason. They wanted to test the uranium-based bomb, then they wanted to test the plutonium-based bomb.
Oh, lovely. Okay.
The two bombs dropped were actually experiments comparing the differences between the two types. We sent scientists to Japan after the bomb drops to analyze the effects of the radiation of the two different bomb types which it had on the people there. The movie claims we just wanted to prove we could do it again. It is certainly not a love affair with the bomb, but it also doesn't really give you an idea of the horrors of nuclear war or nuclear radiation, except through the lens of a very self-absorbed, hallucinatory physicist. Even when slides of Hiroshima victims are being shown to the Los Alamos physicists, we only get to see Oppenheimer's reaction to those images, not the images themselves. The incredible destructive power of H-bomb in comparison to the A-bomb is just represented by circles around Russian cities drawn on a map. There are some surreal intense sex scenes. Most sex scenes, sex is off camera. The insertion of nudity in this biopic is sudden and jarring, and at times definitely feels gracious. There are many minor characters in the story that draw the focus away for a while. Edward Teller makes many appearances. At time he is very pivotal for the story, but at other times he is just a distraction. The movie claims that he is one who initially did calculations that suggested an atomic bomb explosion would ignite the atmosphere in a continuing chain reaction that would destroy planet Earth completely. Much is made of the difference between the almost zero chance of that happening and the fact that the chances were not zero. Other characters who grab the lens for a while include Oppenheimer's girlfriends, one of whom commits suicide, various soldiers, Albert Einstein, and very briefly, President Truman. One other essential fact about Oppenheimer is left out is that he died from throat cancer. Now, it is true that he was a smoker, but it is also true that his cancer could have been caused by exposure to radioisotopes while he was working on that bomb. Just as we can't know an atom's position and velocity, we will never know exactly what caused Oppenheimer's cancer. But it is possible that Like Madame Curie, he ended up sacrificing himself to develop nuclear technology. So, it is both thumbs up and thumbs down for this movie. It is one that you will have to see for yourself. Parts of it are brilliant, the acting is terrific, but the jumbled up storylines and the jarring imagery sometimes make it hard to watch. Okay, now let's hear from our patrons and sponsors.
For a Green Future is also brought to you by the Wood County Park District. The Wood County Park District is a natural resources conservation agency. They protect natural spaces, maintain quality green spaces, provide engaging programming, and they teach people to love and respect nature. They also restore wildlife habitats and lead people on outdoor adventures. Wood County Parks protects natural spaces in Wood County for all to enjoy from 8 a.m. to 30 minutes past sunset every day of the year. There are several ways to get a hold of them and find out what's happening. One is to call them at 419-353-1897. Another is to visit their website, www.wcparks.org. The website again is www.wcparks.org. They are also available on all social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and many others. Just search for WC Parks. That's the Wood County Park District, and we're very grateful for their support.
This show for a Green Future is also brought to you by our patrons. Today, we are very happy to announce that we have a new patron. Rebecca, welcome. Clayton has joined us. Welcome, Clayton. Clayton has joined us at the $50 per month level. We want to express our explosive thanks to Clayton and all our patrons.
Way to go, Clay.
Thank you. Now, patrons are people who have gone to the patreon.com, that's patreon.com, and searched for a Green Future. Our show popped up and they signed up to have a donation which comes out of their account and comes over to us. We thank our patrons because without them, we cannot afford to keep doing this show. Okay, Rebecca, let's get on to your part of the show.
An alert listener sent me in a suggestion, and so apparently it's Japanese beetle season and they are munching away on people's gardens everywhere. To make a long story short on their ecological significance, Japanese beetles belong in Japan, where predators can take care of them. Unfortunately, they are other places like Europe and North America, where they eat everything. Skeletonize plants. It's bad. They are a scarab, apparently. They're a species of scarab. They're between 10-15 millimeters long, so not real large. Scientific name, Papilia japonica. They're real pretty, apparently, so that, you know, that doesn't really help. But they have an iridescent copper elytra, and a green head and thorax, which immediately you say, what the heck is an elytra, Becca? Well, I had to look it up too. And an elytra is a pair of set of modified hardened forewings of beetles, also called a shard. Only one of them is an elytron, but if you are finding single beetle wings around your house, you're probably an entomologist. So usually they come in pairs, as opposed to a hemelytra in true bugs, which a beetle is apparently not a true bug. The hardened forewing actually distinguishes beetles in the order Coleoptera from true bugs, which are in the order Hemiptera. Hemiptera, I think. Go ahead. Feel free to correct my pronunciation. I don't know what I'm doing here. Although they are both in class Insecta. Mm-hmm. So you've got, you know, class Insecta, which is divided up according to whether the forewings are hard or not. Mm-hmm. And okay, some of those other terms. A thorax is the midsection or middle tagma of a hexapod. A hexapod, which is going to be a... It's both a phylum containing both insects and entognatha, which I had never heard of. An entognatha has no wings, and its mouth parts are entognathus, aka retracted into the head. So Yeah. They also, they got a little kind of like spot, white spots, a little feathery white spot sticking out on either side of their carapace. That's how you can tell. I don't know what you're supposed to do if you see one. Probably, you know, I don't know, take a picture and send it to the Ohio Agriculture Extension. That's what everybody says. And they'll monitor it.
And what you mentioned, like retracting neck?
Yeah, that's Entognathus hexapods, though, which are not beetles. Like, a tagma can apparently segments, a tagma is just a segment of a hexapod, so it can be, like, the head, thorax, any kind of parts. They're linked together, sometimes they're fused, or sometimes, you know, like with an ant, you see that they can move their head back and forth, so it can be... Can be jointed also.
Okay.
So that, yeah, that, I learned some terms.
Oh, thank you very much, Rebecca. I mean, you are interesting as always. So, dear listeners, I think it is time for the ecological news. And I will try to take you to the ecological news here. So, story number one. New source of methane adds to global warming. In a July 6th article in the New Scientist, Madeleine Cuff, we're not going to be fancy,
we're from the Midwest here.
She talks about a source of methane that up until now has not been included in global warming simulation. That source is Arctic springs. Oh my God. As glaciers in Arctic melt, they are revealing ground that has been covered in ice for millions of years. Turns out that springs popping up in these areas are releasing many tons of methane into the air.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
That's not what you want.
No. Gabriella Kleber, a scientist at the University of Cambridge. So she's a scientist at the University of Cambridge and is studying these springs in Norway. She discovered them because they give off an intense sulfur smell. Methane, of course, is odorless and colorless. The methane you smell from a leaking stove has an artificial scent added to it.
Right.
It is also possible that if these new sources of methane, which is a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, exists in Arctic, they may also be appearing in the Antarctica as well. It is just another example of positive feedback loop we are stuck in. Moving on to the next news. Japan alienates Asia with the tritium dumping plan. Japan is pushing ahead with its plan to dump more than 1 million gallons of tritium into the Pacific oceans. Despite outcries from the Pacific nations, except Australia, of course, and the United States, many countries have imposed seafood bans from Japan in preparation for the contamination, including China and Hong Kong. The New Zealand-based website on July 7th published a story entitled PIF Panelists Hit Back at the IAEA. Fukushima is a safe decision. Dr. Arjun Makhijani has pointed out that the International Atomic Energy Agency's decision to give Japan the go-ahead for dumping radiation into the ocean violates the IAEA's founding principles. The principle of justification is written into the IAEA's original charter. Any action that it takes has to be justified by the benefit to the world outweighing the harm it might do. The benefit of dumping tritium into ocean is literally just saving the Japanese company TEPCO some money. TEPCO is T-E-P-C-O, TEPCO. The harm to fisheries, fishermen, and ocean ecology is not justified by saving a few yen, especially for TEPCO. while Japan continues to insist the dumping will be safe, it built a kilometer-long tunnel into the ocean to make the release. Why build a kilometer-long tunnel to dump something that's safe? The answer is it is not safe, and the TEPCO employees who will be doing the dumping want it to happen at least a kilometer away from themselves. As we have reported, this dumping is unnecessary because after storage for 10 and a half lives or 120 years, the tritium disappears. Moving on to the next news. France extends nuclear plant outages in August. Nuclear-dependent France is again finding that they can't keep their nuke plants running in hot weather. Bloomberg reports on July 19th that three nuclear plants which had been scheduled to restart in July will be shut until August. The French nuclear operator EDF has been nationalized by the French government because it has gone bankrupt. But all the euros in the world can't provide a nuclear plant with enough money to operate when the rivers needed for cooling them dry up. Mm. Yep. The nukes are also being repaired after the discovery last year of fundamental design flaws that could lead to meltdowns and explosions. The Gravelines nuclear plants on France North Coast and St. Alban nuke on the Rhone River are affected. Moving on to the next news. South Australia continues to march to carbon zero. In the website reneweconomy.com.au, there was a story on July 21st entitled Works Complete to connect South Australia's biggest wind farm to grid. The South Australian company Electranet announced that the first stage of 412 megawatt wind farm named Goyder South has been connected to the grid. Now each turbine can start generating power as soon as it has been completed. The project also includes another 1200 megawatt of wind, 600 megawatts of solar and battery storage of up to 1800 megawatt hours. South Australia is the largest grid in the world, powered primarily by wind and solar power. Currently, it gets more than 70% of its energy from wind and sun alone. It has also made world's headlines by generating more than 100% of its power by renewables for extended periods. This past December, it generated more than 100% for more than 10 consecutive days. Once completed, Goyder South will bump the percentage up over 80%. South Australia is on a steady march to 100% renewable energy. It also has one of the lowest prices for electricity in Australia, while the grids with the highest percentage of fossil fuel generation have the highest electricity prices. So, what I wanted to point out, this was the end of that news story. I just wanted to point out that France is doing it. Australia is trying to do it. Many other countries are trying to do it. I am just wondering, when is the leading superpower, global superpower, global leader, the United States of America, is going to step up and take the lead? United States of America has been the leader since, you know, World War began. World War I, World War II, you know? And we have been in that position. Now, I think we need to... We need this country to transform this leadership and take the country into a new direction. Not only the country, but the entire world. And we have been talking here, we are all interconnected. Now, before I end, let me take you quickly to the last part of this news story. Fungi store carbon in forests. In a June 5th article on the website newscientist.com, Brian Owens wrote an article entitled "Underground Fungi Absorb Up to One-Third of Our Fossil Fuel Emissions." Turn out that Mycorrhizal fungi are absorbing a lot of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere from their association with plants. This type of fungi absorb carbon from plant roots while at the same time supply the plants with vital nutrients such as nitrogen and phosphorus.
Good little mushrooms.
Yeah, mushrooms, I mean, they have some alternate use as well. Yes. I have many friends, they just go mushroom hunting, you know.
Right, yeah.
So up to 30% of carbon is absorbed by plants, gets transferred to these fungi, which stores the carbon in the soil. Researchers calculated that worldwide, this could mean 13 gigatons of carbon dioxide sequestered each year. I mean, fungi are literally helping us, I think.
Good point.
Are helping us more than our political leaders.
Yes.
Please excuse me for that. Yeah, so the report which our staffer has given, it kind of shook me and it was very heartbreaking. Well, this brings out to the end of our show. Thank you for joining us.
And have a good week, everybody.
Thank you.
I don't want no oil, a spoil in my shoreline. I like fish much better than crud. I like birds and things a-creeping and crawling. Won't trade no more oil for blood. The sun don't give us all we need to make this country run. But that black demon oil's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time we was done. I don't want them nukes run by them kooks who think radioactivity is fun. No more three-headed frogs or kids with leukemia. Nuclear power ain't fit for a dog. The sun don't give us all we need to make this country run. But that nuclear power's got us fussing and fighting, and I do believe it's time we was done. No nukes!